In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I are going to be running through six facts about your brain chemistry that can help you achieve peak productivity. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 109. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products. Whether you've built your first product, or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
We're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What is the word this week, sir?
The word of this week is Brooklyn, because I'm back there again.
Is that where you are?
Yep.
And you're meeting with a few entrepreneurs while you're out there?
Yeah. So I'm meeting with James from The Witcher and Corey from The Birdie for dinner on Thursday night. I don't know if anyone else is going to show up, but we'll see how that goes. I think we put out some feelers to some people who might be interested, and hopefully we'll get a small gathering for Thursday night. We're still kind of deciding on where to meet up, but it should be fun.
So did James and Corey live there in Brooklyn or in the area?
They live in the general vicinity.
Well, good. So I have an announcement to make this week. My new product that I'm starting work on right now is called Drip, and you can check out the landing page at getdrip.com. The goal of Drip is to make your website visitors sign up for a trial or to buy, if you don't have a trial, using email follow-up. And it lives in the first segment of email follow-up. You know, there's like email follow-up during trial, email follow-up post-purchase, but then there's that pre-trial thing. It's getting people who just come to visit to get a little more engaged with your product. And it's something that's been highly effective for all of my products. And so we built a nice little engine to do it on Hittail. And we've realized there's a lot of limitations to what we built, and it's already taken a lot of time. And so we're going to start with that and expand it out into a full-blown SaaS product. And in the tests I've done with all my different products, I get anywhere between a 5 and a 20% increase in conversion rate. So that's from visitors to trial. It increases it by about that much. So it's something that if you're only making, if your app's making $1,000 a month, it's probably not worth doing, because a 5, 10% conversion rate, just it doesn't move the needle enough. There's more important things to worry about. But as soon as you get up to, you're making $5,000 or more per month, this is one of those things where the ROI becomes very, very attractive quickly.
Very cool. So we have a lot of podcast love this week, and I wanted to share a couple of them. First one's from Matt, and he says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. Just wanted to give you a big thanks for all the podcasts. I've just launched my own SaaS app called Icon Practice, which I doubt I could have done without your help. I've listened to all your episodes and got something from each one. Thanks again, Matt." And we'll link to that in the show notes. And the second one is from Ryan, who says, "Mike, Rob, you guys are awesome. Your show is compelling listening. It's a goldmine for us all around the world striving to make it online." And I did not in any way, shape, or form modify this. This is word for what he says. He says, "Every show delivers. Startups for the Rest of Us is perfectly balanced with delicious tips, wicked insight, and practical, actionable advice and inspiration for every aspiring digital entrepreneur, and I had to write to personally thank you for helping me and thousands like me on the journey. It is truly appreciated. Best, Ryan."
We should change our podcast synopsis to be that very phrase. That is so well-crafted.
You think so?
Ryan, you are a wordsmith, sir. I tip my hat to you.
And our third one is from Chris, who says, "I've been podcasting since 2005, and I subscribe to about 70 podcasts, but you had a number in your list that I think I'll enjoy. Thanks for the list. I've not written down my list in a couple of years before I discovered your show, which has definitely become one of my favorites." So we'll link to his list in the show notes, but just wanted to say thanks to Matt, Ryan, and Chris, who send in all that podcast love, and want to say we really appreciate it.
Very nice. Now, we also have a listener question we're going to get into before we get into the facts about brain chemistry. You want to read that?
Yeah. So this one's from JT, and he says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. I've been listening to your podcast for about a year now, and I love it. It's been very helpful. Keep up the good work. I recently developed via Odesk a personal finance iPhone app called Money WYN, which is Money Within Your Needs. I've had a couple people tell me that I should create an Android version or that they don't have smartphones at all. So I've begun looking at turning it into a SaaS app so that more users can access it. That actually was part of my end goal anyway. I put up an MVP site at withinyourneeds.com to gauge interest. I have a couple of issues going about this. First, I know what I want the app to do, but I'm not very creative, so I don't think I can design the app myself and make it look good. I had the same issue with the iPhone version. The app does at its basic level what I want it to do, but I think it can look a lot better. So do I hire a web designer and then pass the design to a developer to code everything, or do I create my own mock-ups of how I want everything to look and pass that to a developer? Second, what is an appropriate level of interest for my MVP site? I've started to get ad clicks in the day since I put the site up, but not sure at what point I can deem there's an appropriate level of interest. Any thoughts would be appreciated. Thanks."
Wow, this is a tough one. This kind of app, this personal finance app, it's a super competitive market. There are so many of these apps out there, and typically to take any kind of control of the market, you're going to need to go free and because you're aimed at consumers, and then try to have some kind of paid upgrade or make money like Mint does, where you get to scale and you have, you know, obviously have to raise funding to get there. And then they make like recommendations of credit cards and they basically make affiliate money. So I guess that'd be my first inclination. Now, I understand MoneyWYN, the iPhone app could feasibly make it work because the iPhone App Store provides ongoing sources of traffic that are really inexpensive. And so even at a $99 or $4.99 price point, you can do it. But I don't know, my initial inclination just of the idea is like, wow, why would I use this over the literally 20, 30 others of these that I've seen launch within the last 2 years that are SaaS apps?
Interestingly enough, one of the guys I'm meeting with on Thursday, his name's Corey, and he runs The Birdie. And The Birdie is also a personal finance application, which is a SaaS app. It's on the web. And what he did for his differentiating factor was that he makes it accessible via email, and the application emails you during the week. And I'm not familiar with all the details of exactly how the app works, but it is heavily, heavily reliant upon email communication with the users, because that interaction with people who use email is so high that if it's a SaaS application and it's just sitting out there, you might not necessarily think about it. And his application, I believe it emails you and asks you what you spent money on that day. So people use it as kind of a to-do list, and then he parses the emails and does a lot of things with them. And he, you know, is doing reasonably well with it. I think his pricing is around $4.95 a month for it. But with an iPhone version, obviously you're only going to get the people who have iPhones, first of all. Second of all, the recurring revenue is just not there. And as you pointed out, having lots and lots of competition in this space is one of those overwhelming things that you have to come out with some sort of marketing strategy that is going to overcome all of that. One of the questions I would have is just, how do you overcome that marketing challenge? And I don't think that it's about getting people to use your app and say, yes, this is a good app that I would use. It's more or less, how do you identify the people who you want to come use your app and then get them to your website such that they will actually use it? I see that as more of a marketing challenge versus what I think that you're concentrating on in your first question is, how do I make the application look better? And I don't think that's your problem at all. I think that you're focusing in the wrong place. I think you need to focus on, how do I get traffic to my site such that people will use it? And I think that's a much bigger problem than making it look good.
Yeah, I would agree. Let's just say that you are able to answer that. You want to move on to the question of, how do you build it? Your question was, do I hire a web designer and then pass the design to a developer to code, or do I create my own mockups and look to pass to a developer? Well, if you're not a designer, you're going to need someone to design the app, to create the look and feel, because otherwise you're going to wind up with a very poor UI, because developers, as a rule, do not have design skills. Some of them obviously do, but most do not. And I'm one included, that I have no design skills. So when I used to code things, even when I was building my own apps, I would have a designer create mockups, create HTML, send it to me, and then I would code it up. So that'd be my answer to your question of being creative and making things look attractive, is that you would find a designer who's reasonable, and depending on your budget, and then you would describe either the pages that you want or even the high-level functions, and then pay that designer to create basically individual mockups of each of those pages, make sure that everything's in there, and then have him create Photoshop files and either have him then create the HTML or have that go to a service and you know, find someone on Odesk basically to create the HTML, then hand that to a developer and have them build it out. You could also, you know, the developer may be able to do HTML. I mean, it all depends on overlapping skill sets, but in general, that's the process that I follow, is I try to find people who are experts at design, experts at cutting to HTML, and experts at development, and then going through those three steps. In terms of your second question, it says, what is an appropriate level of interest for my MVP site? And what he has is a landing page, and it just has a couple bullet points and then kind of a thing to sign up for a mailing list. I mean, I think at this point, I think the page needs some work, because it looks rudimentary. I don't think you're going to get much interest here. I think you'll want a designer to mock something up. But it's a tough question to answer, because it depends on your revenue model. If you have a SaaS application that's going to charge $50 a month, then you need a heck of a lot fewer emails than you do if you're going to have something that's a freemium model and only going to have 1% of people convert to a very low paying, you know, or low revenue plan. It's a huge, I mean, it literally can be 100x difference between those two. If you're using ads and sending people to the site and you're not getting at least 15 to 20% of people to opt in, then I think you're going to have a problem long term, because I think you're just going to have to pay way too much for people to sign up for your app. And unless you have a really good revenue model, you're not going to make enough money to pay back the acquisition costs.
So JT, hopefully that helps answer your questions and give you some idea of a direction to go.
This week, we're diving into six facts about your brain chemistry that can help you achieve peak productivity. And I created this outline based on a book I recently read. It's called Your Brain at Work, and it's written by a psychologist named David Rock. And he's studied brain chemistry, brain functioning, and he's just gathered a community of psychologists and neuroscientists and all types of people who study the brain. And he's had a few conferences, and then he's kind of put all his knowledge into day-to-day application. And so the book, Your Brain at Work, is really interesting because it's not written, it has a lot of really deep research content in it, but it's written using day-to-day scenarios. It's written about this husband and wife who are both professionals, and the husband is like a software consultant, and the wife, I think, organizes conferences. And so it'll give a scenario where like the wife's in a meeting and this happens, and everything goes bad because of it, you know, and then it'll go into why the brain chemistry and how that works and why things went bad. And then here are the things you can do to help your brain chemistry adjust and how you can perform better in that meeting. And then it'll redo the same story with her making different decisions. So when I first heard the premise of it, I thought it was pretty cheesy and I figured I'd be skipping around a lot. But the author actually does a good job of mixing what would otherwise be very dry material, very academic material, and interspersing it with interesting stories. And then you start liking the characters in the story, you know, it just takes you away. So there is a ton of information in this book, and I just picked out six tidbits that I thought were most applicable to our audience. So the first fact about your brain that can help you achieve peak productivity is that every time your brain works on an idea consciously, it uses a measurable and limited resource. So in other words, doing really hard thinking, doing really hard tasks like writing or outlining a podcast, something that's intense thinking, it actually depletes your mental energy for that day, and you have a very finite amount. And it actually burns more sugar from your bloodstream when you do that. So long-haul truckers, they can drive 16, 20 hours a day. I mean, they eventually get tired, but it doesn't actually tax them mentally because it's a rote, like muscle memory task. You don't have to think actively to do it. But no professional writer, if you ever hear Stephen King, Stephen Pressfield, someone who does professional writing for a living, they typically write 3 to 4 hours tops at a stretch. And outside of that, and basically waste that resource on things that aren't important.
I've seen a couple of studies on this as well that indicate the same types of thing. And it's funny because I've noticed the same thing myself when I'm working. If I have an extended amount of time off, the pressure is kind of there for me to sit down and work for 8 or 10 or 12 hours straight because I have that time available to me. But if I'm sitting there working on stuff that tends to be very difficult to do, like certain programming tasks, then I can't just sit there and do it because what ends up happening is I'll get 3 or 4 hours of solid work time in, and it will be really good. And then after that, my brain just sort of shuts down and I just don't seem to get nearly as much done.
Yeah, and that's why thinking about your conscious thinking as a like a precious resource to conserve can be helpful for trying to identify that time of day when you have that optimum functioning. Because if you pair your optimum functioning time of day with short bursts, so say you just block out your calendar for 2 hours and you say, turn the phone off, turn the email off, and I'm going to write copy or I'm going to write this intense piece of code just for these 2 hours, you can get enormous amounts done, literally 2 to 3 times what you would get done if you had interruptions and you were working, you know, at a non-peak time, like if the afternoon time is not your peak time. So I think there's a lot to be said here. What's interesting about each of these points as we go through is some of them, I think you'll probably already know intuitively, but you may not have actually said this out loud before or not realized it. I've already started doing this one here without knowing it. And in the mornings, I drink some coffee, I work very intently. And then the early afternoons, I just find are not peak times for me. And then late in, like in the evening after the kids go to bed, are another peak time. And I find that I get a lot of work done then, and I focus really intently on those times. And I think you can actually, that's why you can work, you know, a 20 or 30 hour week and actually get more done than if you were sitting in an office somewhere in a cubicle, getting interrupted all the time, just with ambient noise around the office. And it's just a lot different working arrangement and allows your brain to function at its optimum level.
Part of those 40-hour work weeks that a lot of people end up working is more because, you know, the companies kind of force you to put the time in versus put the work in. Because they're paying you for your time. That's really what it comes down to. But at the same time, they're not necessarily paying you for productivity.
Our second fact about your brain chemistry is the less you hold in your mind at once, the better. So this comes back to the brain being a measurable and limited resource. But in this sense, it's decluttering your mind. And so this is actually, you know, if you've read Getting Things Done, the GTD method, he talks a lot about removing that mental stress of holding a lot of things in your mind at once. And I think that the answer to this, or if you're not already writing things down and having to-do lists, and anytime you think of something you need to do, emailing it to yourself or somehow capturing that in a way that is not sitting in your mind, basically, you know, slowly stressing your mind out and making your mind tired, then you need to start doing that, because this absolutely is one that will impact your peak productivity over time. And people who try to remember things and carry more in their mind, you never give your mind a rest, even when you're not thinking about those hard things. And so when you need to think about hard things, your mind is tired from carrying this weight around.
Yeah, I do this a lot myself. I mean, just writing things down all the time. And regardless of whether it's stuff that I'm writing down to create a list of things to do, just the very act of writing those things down so that I don't have to try and remember them, I've found that to be very helpful. And it's funny because this reminds me of Joel Spolsky's comment on his painless bug tracking post from years and years ago, where he basically said that he was, at any given time, I can only remember two bugs. If you ask me to remember three, one of them will fall on the floor and get swept under the bed with the dust bunnies who will eat it.
Yeah, I remember that post as well. You know, I've taken a lot away from both his writings and just other writings on getting organized. And what you'll realize, they all kind of start to say the same thing under the covers. And that's because there is some science to it. And we do all kind of, you know, as humans, work in similar fashions the deeper you dig. So the third one is performing multiple conscious tasks at once results in a big drop off in accuracy or performance. So this is the multitasking myth. Now, the interesting thing is that they've done research and they've actually found that 5% of people can actually multitask and they actually do get more done faster, but that 95% of people do not. And so the odds are that you are not one of those people that can multitask. And I know for a fact that I am not. And most programmers who I know who are very good at programming are not good multitaskers, because they tend to be really focused. And that is a gift unto itself, right? To be able to focus and to be able to hold large numbers of things in your mind. Having that and multitasking they don't tend to go together.
Now, was there anything in there that kind of indicated how to identify yourself as somebody who could multitask effectively, or no?
No, it didn't. And in fact, that 5% number it didn't come from this book. It came from a book I read last month that talked about this topic as well. And neither of them said how you would identify for yourself. Yeah. I do know a couple people, actually, women are more likely to be in that 5%. I do know a few people who are actually, just from experience, from working with them.
Cool.
Number four is that switching between tasks uses energy, and that if you do it a lot, you will make more mistakes and you won't get things done as quickly. There have been studies done in offices where they say if you're working in a cubicle or an office, that you, on average, you work on a single task for 11 minutes before an interruption. And that is catastrophic, especially if you're trying to do long, you know, creative tasks like programming or copywriting or designing or anything. The interruptions, like I said before, if you can block out 2 hours of time, and I came up with this thought today, I call it striping, and I've started doing this to my calendar, where when I'm doing thought-intensive work, I'm going to put a 1 or 2 hour block in my calendar and color it a certain way, and then the next 1 or 2 hour block is going to be, you know, the opposite, kind of the low mental energy mode of thinking. And so I can let my mind rest for that, and so it'll kind of look like a striped pattern because it'll be every other. But I think that's not only something I'm going to start doing, but something that I think we need to be more deliberate about doing, and about during those schedule blocks of the intense time, that's when you shut everything down. You shut your email down, you shut your phone down, the whole deal. And I think learning to be aware of your levels of alertness and your kind of your interest throughout the day really leads you to find a time of day when you're going to get your best work done. And if your mind begins to wander, then you need to ask yourself, wow, am I just too tired, mentally tired to do this right now? Or do I need to, you know, to kind of refocus?
So are you saying that in a roundabout way, Microsoft has killed millions and millions of hours of productivity because of that little ding that Outlook plays when an email comes in?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I do not get a ding or any notification when emails show up on any device of mine.
Yeah. I don't either, with one exception, and I don't know how to turn it off, but I have an Exchange account. Whenever I have the web interface open and I get an email, it dings. So typically I have the sound turned off on my computer when I'm working. So.
Indeed. You know, I have the Gmail tab open quite a bit in Chrome, and I turn that off several times a day now for stretches of, you know, between 30 minutes and an hour, just because I find myself naturally wanting to go back to it. Because when I get into a kind of a hard thinking time, and let's say I am writing some copy or writing some really intense code, your mind wants to shy away from that because it is so exhausting. And so that's what procrastination is it's your mind trying to sneakily give itself a rest. So I'm not making this up.
You're making it sound like, no, our brains are slackers, or they want to be slackers.
That's what it says. Like, your brain tends towards the lowest risk and the highest rewards and the least output of energy. Like, it just naturally goes to those areas. And so what that means is that it really does. When you're taxing it and you're thinking intently, any chance you give it, it will wander away and it will say, oh, Hacker News. Oh, this is so much more appealing and so much fun. It's like a brain's trip to Disneyland instead of, you know, sitting there trying to write two pages of intense copy or deal with some complex codings. So fact five that can help you achieve peak productivity is that peak mental performance requires just the right level of stress, not minimal stress. And this comes back to, there's something called the Yerkes-Dodson Law. And those were two psychologists that studied peak performance, the ability to focus and think. They uncovered that when you have minimal stress, that you actually don't perform as well, because there's certain things in your blood that are required in order for your mind to really hyper-focus. And you actually need to have a little bit of stress about it. And that's why a lot of people work better with some deadlines. And a lot of people work better if they're concerned about something. Like, if you're going to do a talk tomorrow, then that can tend to motivate you to do really good work and to be pretty focused, right? And to actually crank out some pretty good stuff. I have to be honest, in my experience, caffeine helps this. And this was not in the book. Now, the flip side to this is if you get too stressed, you hit a level where your performance starts degrading because you get too much stress and your brain starts to shut down. So there is a careful balance there.
I think that caffeine and alcohol kind of go hand in hand as well. I mean, both of them act to help you kind of cut down on outside stimuli and focus on whatever it is that you're actually looking at. So I can definitely see how caffeine would do that. I don't know the scientific explanations behind it, but, you know, in the morning when I have coffee and I'm sitting there working, it definitely helps me focus on whatever it is that I'm doing. If I'm sitting there doing a programming task, you know, late in the afternoon or whatever, because I would not admit to drinking before noon, but if for any reason sitting there working on stuff, it seems like my focus tends to be much higher. I don't know if that relates back to the productivity, but it definitely seems that way.
And our sixth and final fact about your brain chemistry that can help you achieve peak productivity is that focused attention changes the brain. This is something that the author harped on a lot in the book, and I really took it home. He basically said that the brain, the internal structure, is constantly changing and adapting. That's why habits are relatively easy to form. They may not be as easy to break, but you can get into patterns and thinking patterns relatively easy, because if you focus a lot of attention on something, your brain changes fairly quickly. It's surprising how quickly it can adapt. So what that means is that if you spend a lot of time being distracted, checking email and moving to Hacker News and always listening kind of to your brain and letting it be lazy and pull you away from your important tasks, your brain will actually not totally lose the ability, but it will veer away. It'll make it easier for you to continue in that pattern. Whereas if you make very deliberate choices and you start, whether it's doing the striping technique I mentioned or just forcing yourself to be really focused, turning off distractions, your brain changes. It will actually change the chemistry of it so that you will be more likely to get into focus, to get into flow quicker, just to perform at a higher level. So this was actually both good news and bad news, right? It's easier to fall into bad patterns, but it's easy to get out of them if you're very deliberate. If you know yourself, you learn to monitor your levels of alertness and interest throughout the day, if you're just deliberate about performing and keeping the six things we've mentioned here in mind.
In a way, that seems kind of bizarre to be able to do that, because you're trying to trick your brain into doing certain things in a specific pattern, but it's your brain that's tricking your brain. That just seems very Inception-ish.
It's a dream within a dream, for sure. So to recap, our six facts about your brain chemistry that can help you achieve peak productivity are, Number one, every time the brain works on an idea consciously, it uses a measurable and limited resource. Number two is the less you hold in your mind at once, the better. Number three, performing multiple conscious tasks at once results in a big drop-off in accuracy or performance. Number four is switching between tasks uses energy. If you do it a lot, you make more mistakes. Number five is that peak mental performance requires just the right level of stress, not minimal stress. And number six is that focused attention changes your brain. We have some extra time here, Mike. You want to answer a couple listener questions?
Sure. So the first one we have is from Soren Jacobson, and he says, "Hi, guys. Loving your podcast. I have a question for you. In an episode recently, you talked about level one apps, and that was a good way to start. Can you give some real examples of what level one apps can be? I don't want to go into iPhone apps. I was thinking more like web apps with recurring revenue. That would not cost a fortune to outsource. I cannot code it, but I'm a good marketer. I have some level zero websites with AdSense and affiliates that bring in around $2,000 a month, but I want to step away from that quote-unquote sleazy market over time and focus more on my own applications. Thanks, Soren."
So to start with, I don't actually think that all level zero apps are sleazy, but you can certainly be in level zero, which is kind of like AdSense and affiliate stuff, without catering to just the dating and weight loss niches. But your question was about level one, and that this references back to episode 102, which was four levels of income generating web apps. And a level one web app is a low competition niche app. So typically this is something that has autopilot marketing. So you either have a nice stream of traffic, very low cost, typically from either Google, it can be from YouTube, it can be from Amazon, WordPress, iPhone App Store. You have to find a source of traffic that's fairly consistent and that it's not paid acquisition strategy. So you just get in the path of that traffic, and as long as it converts, it can generate some income. And the examples that I threw out a few in that episode, but a good example is like a WordPress plugin, iPhone apps, which you said, I guess you don't want to get into. Anything that ranks for a niche term, something like Apprentice Lyman Jobs, which is one of my apps, is like that, right? It has good SEO rankings, and so it has good rankings in Google, and so that's where it gets a good chunk of its traffic. Even like a wedding website builder, like Wedding Toolbox, that could also be in this low competition level one niche area. So hope that helps.
The next question we have is from Tom, and he says, "Hi, Rob and Mike. I got a question for both of you. I've been doing development for 10 years now, and I'm ready to go out on my own. I want to create software products and go into consulting, preferably PHP custom business applications to help bootstrap my business. Should I create two separate business entities for both businesses? I know Mike has two different companies for both, but I know companies like 37 Signals do both consulting and create products, or does it not really even matter? Again, thanks for your time, Tom."
So to start, 37 Signals doesn't do consulting. They used to, and they turned it into a product business. So as far as I know, they haven't done consulting for 5 or 7 years. It's been quite a while. There are some companies that still do both, but most that I know, as soon as they're able to, they leave consulting behind. I think there's really two questions here, Mike. There's a question that he asked, which is whether he should have two different companies for these. But the bigger question I have is, are you leaving salaried employment to start a consulting firm and to try to launch products? Because that's a lot to take on all at once. And if you have a decent salary job where you're not working a bazillion hours a week and you're reasonably happy, I would say stay at your salary job for now. Don't take on all the headaches of getting into consulting and trying to build that business, because that's going to take all your time and you're not going to have time to build products. So if ultimately where you want to go is products and you do have that job thing kind of dialed in, I would stick there and launch the product. Now, if you don't have a salary job, you've already dove into consulting full-time, then that's the way it is. And then, you know, I think we can answer the business entities question from there.
Yeah, I would totally agree with Rob. If you have that salaried employment and things are going reasonably well, definitely stick around until you can get your own products launched and launch them on the side. And I think that you'll find that you're probably a lot happier, and it will probably work out a lot better for you in the long run, just because you'll have that stability behind you, versus when you dive into consulting, you generally have to pick up all the pieces, all the paperwork of, you know, things like payroll and insurance and all the other things that go with it. And it can be a real nightmare to deal with. So if you don't have to deal with all that stuff, I wouldn't do it. That said, if you're in that other situation, then you have to deal with the question of, you know, do I open up a second entity for a business or not? And I think for that, the primary reason that I had two companies was because the businesses were radically different enough that I didn't want them intertangled. I didn't want people coming to the website and trying to figure out, well, are they a product business? Are they a consulting business? And part of it was also just the fact that
you had a high liability, right? High exposure.
And part of it had to do with insurance. So I had a lot of legal liabilities associated with the consulting. I mean, if you're doing custom programming and development, chances are pretty good that you are not going to incur a lot of liability. And there's just not a lot of risk for things going wrong. What I was doing was I was actually going on site with clients and I was working on their production systems. So like production databases, production servers. Typically, I was directly on their network and was touching, you know, thousands and thousands of computers in environments. I mean, there were some companies I went into where I would literally install software in some way, shape, or form on more than 50,000 computers. And when you get into a situation like that, you really want to be able to limit the liability. And part of having that second company was so that I could put a dividing line between the two companies and I could work on my products, have them under the software business. I could do the consulting under the consulting business. And if the consulting business ever got sued into oblivion, then I didn't necessarily have to worry about it taking down my software business as well. And I could, you know, have that very clear dividing line between them. For me, it was more peace of mind than anything else.
Whereas I did consulting under a single company. First, I was a sole proprietor, so it wasn't even really a much of a formal company. And then I eventually moved it to an LLC. And when I launched products, I didn't really want to go to the headache of managing two entities. There was both the cost with it as well as the paperwork. It was more paperwork because I despise all the tax filings and all that stuff. And so I just kept it under the umbrella of that LLC. And then I stopped doing consulting and all my products are, you know, are essentially under that now. So there's never been a reason for me to change that. I mean, I guess I did have several years where they overlapped, you know, the consulting and the products, but it does depend on risk tolerance. If you really want to be all buttoned up, then yeah, you'd have a different, realistically, you'd have a different company for every one of your products that earns more than $1,000 or $2,000 a month or something. But that would just, there'd just be a lot of paperwork and headache in that. And so I think you just have to weigh that out. A lot of people I know do the single company and put everything underneath it. And, you know, that can work for you as well, as long as you don't have a lot of liability involved.
So, Tom, hopefully that answers your question. And thanks for writing in. If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.